The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Now, David, we had you in Singapore last week and this week Beijing. What are you seeing? You said that you were going to have your boots on the ground. You were going to see firsthand what you would recommend for people to be watching for in China. What trends are you seeing right now?
Well, just to contrast the region for you, Hong Kong is really a place where a lot of investment banking occurs. Singapore is a place where a lot of asset management is being directed to. That's sort of the popular trend at this point is regionally, it is the hub for wealth management and asset management. And Beijing and Shanghai are the two great cities in China. Of course, there's more than that that are phenomenal in terms of size and import. But Beijing being the head and heart of that place, if you will, because it is the locus of government.
Well, David, for people who've not been over there, they're three very different places, not just in what they do, but they have three separate currencies. And so as you travel from place to place over there, you're using either Hong Kong dollars or Singapore dollars or in Beijing, yuan. Is that correct?
That's right. And, you know, if you're reading The Economist these days, you'll see in the most recent issue, the Big Mac Index is back, and the Big Mac Index is a way that The Economist gauges what currencies around the world are either overvalued or undervalued relative to a Big Mac. And of course, the Big Mac's priced in dollars, so it's really overvaluation and undervaluation compared to the U.S. dollar. But the Big Mac is that ubiquitous piece of beef that you can pick up on any corner virtually anywhere in the world.
Well, and David, they tell us it's beef, but it's a $4.50 investment. You know, I mean, they tell us it's beef, but it's $4.50 for something fairly small. So is the dollar still overvalued relative to the currencies that they measured against?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you have to observe with that is that the renminbi or yuan, it goes by two names, the Hong Kong dollar and the Singapore dollar, all distinct currencies. They are undervalued compared to the Big Mac priced in U.S. dollars. Now, that begs the question, is it the U.S. dollar, in fact, that's overvalued, or are these currencies undervalued? The policy guys back in D.C. have argued that the renminbi needs to appreciate, and in fact, the global imbalances economically that we have today are in large part because of an undervalued renminbi. But I think what's very disingenuous, in fact, unfair about that, is that if the one side of the coin is renminbi being undervalued, then the very other side of the coin is that the dollar may in fact be overvalued. And I think that's an uncomfortable truth for Washington, far more uncomfortable than the benefit they get from slinging mud in the direction of Beijing in terms of currency manipulation and whatnot.
Well, and David, you know, you've been watching what businessmen do versus what the actual people are told to do. It can be two very different things. Businessmen have a tendency to see these things ahead of time and either move in and take advantage of it or quickly move out. You know, I'm thinking about the businesses in China. One of the things that you had brought out last time was Singapore seems to be receiving an awful lot of exiting Chinese or Beijing currency and assets right now. Are you seeing an exit out of China, or are you seeing entrance into that market?
What we see, if you want an example, let's use FIFO, that is first in, first out, an accounting method, just as an analogy. FIFO is that accounting method that recognizes inventory that is oldest as that which is sold first. So again, that's first in to inventory and first out in terms of the sales recognition. But if you take the concept and apply that to the emerging markets, you find that businesses and business leaders in particular are usually the first into an emerging market, and they're the ones who are the keenest in terms of having a sense for future profit, recognizing opportunities in the marketplace in their fledgling state. So they're the first in, and they're also the first out. It's the business community in emerging markets that's equally keen on risk mitigation, on avoiding changes that negatively impact the bottom line. So you often see the same theme across emerging markets on a first out basis as well. This is what has been happening in China. That's not to say that there's not new deals, new business being done at a vibrant business community. It's in terms of all of Asia, it still is probably the strongest economy. But U.S. Treasury studies on the outflow of illicit funds from China skyrocketed starting in 2010. So from 2010, 2011 to the present, you've had this unabated flow of capital out of China into anything else. And in this case, you're dealing with Chinese business leaders, again, that from 2010 to the present, they've assessed the prospects for political change, economic change, and frankly, they're determining on a very self-interested basis to go ahead and just take a few of their own chips off the table.
Well, David, you mentioned last week that real estate markets in Singapore and Hong Kong are getting an awful lot of this exiting money coming into it, to the point where it's starting to burst at the seams.
Well, and they've had to actually change rules, both in Singapore and Hong Kong, new rules and limitations to address the flood of money that's coming towards them, with Singapore actually altering residency requirements, simply unable to handle the increased traffic into what is frankly a very tiny country. So, yeah, real estate is certainly that. Singapore has seen that huge inflow. Hong Kong, Vancouver, you can go farther afield in terms of major cities around the world. They're seeing Chinese purchases of real estate, and it's money that they want out of China. Now, FIFO, I just, again, think about that, because as we often have discussed on the program, insider selling in the United States, where the chiefs of these companies have looked ahead to the business opportunities immediately on the horizon, and frankly, the constraints to business growth and market expansion. And guess what they choose? They choose to reduce their personal exposure to the very companies which they're managing. And, you know, that says something, doesn't it?
That's exactly right, David. When you see the presidents of corporations getting out of their own corporation and selling the stock, you know, granted, that may be to raise a little bit of capital for themselves, but usually it's a sign that they're getting off of the ship. And what you're saying is maybe it's not happening in mass right now, but it's happening enough that the personal assets of the Chinese, the people inside of China, they're moving those assets out. You said, according to this Treasury study, it's at record pace at this point. So what is that saying about China? I mean, is this a little bit like the canary in the coal mine?
Well, exactly. What does it tell you when the elite in China begin to exercise a plan B? And that's something that you should not, you cannot ignore. And certainly, there is change coming. What kind of change is less clear? I think no one has a crystal ball. Is it simply the market offering less opportunities and the smart people are reducing sort of their personal balance sheet risk by diversifying into other assets? That's very prudent. That makes sense. Or is it an economic change that shifts the dynamics and benefits from producers, manufacturers, exporters, to consumers? That's a big change. That's a big question mark. Is that what they're anticipating? This would be good for the man on the street. In this case, that sort of change may be unwelcome by the producers, even if in the long run they would benefit from it too. Well, I think what part of the issue here is people are thinking in shorter and shorter time frames. Getting rich quickly is more in vogue today than sort of the slow traditional way of growing wealth and growing a business enterprise. And so if things are changing, the question is, are they willing to stick with the slower rates of growth that are ahead for China, or is it time to cash in? Again, there's more unanswered questions for us than answered questions here, but it's absolutely important to figure out why people in the business community are taking money out of the country. Never a good sign.
Well, and David, one of the things that you've pointed out and try to program into this program with guests that are far broader than just the financial questions or the business questions. My question, you know, and this goes to our interview with Minxin Pei just a few weeks ago. Could it be anticipation for political change that's causing these private enterprises or these personal assets to be moving outside of China?
Yeah, you know, when you have a shift in leadership, and this is just a moving, an appointment, if you will. Of course, it's a one-party deal, so it's not like there's official elections or a democratic process. But you're going to have new appointees in leadership here this next year, and they may take a different approach to the implementation of this five-year plan. They may look at future five-year plans at the end of this one, 4.5 years out, and have a very different point of emphasis. Is it more of a hard-line emphasis? Or is it something that is more, again, what we've kind of contrasted as And the Washington consensus, more of an emphasis on transparency, the rule of law, things that would, in fact, allow for the Chinese market to expand and grow and become, frankly, the dominant player in the region, if not one of the dominant players or the dominant player ultimately in the world.
Well, and we've already experienced the fact that China cannot depend on America or Europe anymore. I mean, China has for 40 years pretty much depended on America's ability to borrow money and spend it in China. At this point, it has to be internal consumption or it's not going to be driven at all, is it?
Well, we're just, again, we're shifting from the old growth model and we're moving to the new growth model, and we hope that they can do that. In essence, China can't depend, as you say, cannot depend on the U.S. and Europe for future growth. To do so, I mean, again, we're dealing with our own constraints domestically, and this has everything to do with credit contracting in the U.S. and Europe, and, you know, if nothing else, being stagnant and not growing the way it did for 25, 30 years plus. And so we have consumers that are constrained. They're not spending out of their savings, and they don't have access to credit, so it's not like they can go out and buy more than they can actually afford, which impacts the end manufacturer. Now we're talking about China. So, yeah, something has to change because they have benefited from U.S. overconsumption by supplying us with all that our hearts could desire. Now we don't have the cash, and they've got to figure out either a new market to sell into, which they may very well do, other continents, other people, or they just have to figure out a new growth model, which is what they're trying to do.
Well, David, I can't miss this. I mean, here we are. We're watching the Olympics in London right now. And of course, the idea is that this is going to be an economic boom for England, that they got the Olympics. But you're in the city that had the Olympics just recently as well, Beijing, the Beijing Olympics. What's your thought as far as economic impact on having an Olympics in your particular town? What's that do for the economics of the surrounding area and the city itself?
We drove outside of town to see the famous bird's nest where much of the 2008 Olympics took place here in Beijing. And very telling. I mean, other than an occasional soccer game, the facility goes unused. That's what we're told by locals. And by the looks of it, it's quiet. It is dead quiet. So, you know, it's still not clear to me that hosting the games is anything more than, number one, good PR for the country that's hosting, and number two, an opportunity for politicians to give development projects to their friends and family. You know, again, very little lasting benefit to the community. And certainly we could say that there's just not much positive return on the dollars invested. But we saw this in Salt Lake City as well. This is not Beijing or London. This is every city that does this. Salt Lake City, there was a skew select Salt Lake City families that handled all the infrastructure improvements. PR was nice, and that kind of lingers as the community that hosted the games, but the real benefit was to a few families within that area, whether it's Salt Lake City, Beijing, London. Beyond that, I think Cameron is going to look back and say, that was really a mistake. Of course, he wasn't in office when they did the bid and everything else, but if they spend $10 billion plus to get it there, they've got a pretty high bar in terms of revenues over the next couple of years to hopefully generate just to break even.
Well, and David, let's look at a model here for a second. I'm going to shift away from the Olympics and back over to just the economics of China. China has benefited through the years of the American ability to float bonds, basically to borrow money, and then take that borrowed money and invest it in China. Now, China is realizing at this point, we're starting to run out of that ability. So America is no longer the impact that it was before. China has not been able to create bonds and internationally trade those bonds because that just has not been an entrance into the Western markets. We've not really allowed them to have the yuan as an international currency. But that's changing, isn't it? I'm hearing that China now, one of the ways that they're going to finance themselves is to turn around and create internationally traded bonds. And are you seeing signs of that?
Yuan-denominated bonds were issued this week to a number of African central banks. Specifically, the Tanzanian and Nigerian central banks were offered the bonds as an addition to their foreign exchange reserves. So this is a trend to watch. This is something that today may be a trickle, tomorrow may be a flood. But what you have is currency reserve diversification, not only away from dollars, but towards the Chinese RMB, or yuan, as it's often called. This internationalization process of the RMB or yuan, it's a slow process. But one where gradual progress is being made, we have examples of that even this week. So we made the point in our last DVD that over the next several years, we'd see a crowding out, if you will, of the private sector in favor of public sector IOUs, both old ones coming due and new ones being issued to meet current funding needs. We may very well find that U.S. Treasury purchases are affected at the margins, adding pressure to both the price and interest rate trends in that market. It's not only a currency reserve issue, but the countries interested in expanding their yuan or RMB exposure are consistently the same countries moving towards settling trade in that currency as well. And again, this is what we noted in the last DVD, that is to the exclusion of U.S. dollar invoicing and U.S. dollar trade settlement.
Well, and David, we've been the only game in town up to this point, you know, with treasury bills. Our treasury bills are, you've talked about this in the past, we have interest rate repression right now, or financial repression, which means that our government can keep interest rates unnaturally low. They don't match the risk that's taken when you buy a U.S. treasury. Now, when you have these other entrants into the market, like China, that takes a little of the control over interest rates and what we have to pay away from us, does it not?
Oh, of course. The Standard Bank calculated that for 2011, there was 36 billion yuan worth of trade, which was settled, again, in that currency. And again, that's just a start, but it's a start nonetheless. And it's a hugely important slow burn issue as it applies to the U.S. dollar and the erosion, if you will, of world reserve currency status. If you reflect on it, frankly, it's easier for all of us to imagine sort of cataclysm and in an instant change that you can account for. It's that slow process of erosion stretched over months or years where we tend to lose focus because the nature of the event is so tedious. And that's really what we're talking about, is a number of ways in which, chipped away a little at a time, is this monolithic stature of world reserve currency status. And this is just one area. Again, the issuance of RMB bonds or yuan-denominated bonds, this is monumental, even if it's minor in terms of the dollar value, because what it signals is a transition. It signals a change in people's mind. And when people have a change in their intellectual schema, then their actions tend to follow, and their actions get in line with what their thoughts have been previously. We see that not only there, but we're also seeing it in the gold market.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting as you see the trend changing where a person who in the past from another country would say, well, we have to settle this in dollars. They're finding creative ways not to settle things in dollars, like you said, either with their own currencies internally or with assets internally. You know, Iran, when we put this embargo on Iran, the idea at that point was for China to possibly start buying its oil from Iran in gold. So as this paradigm shift occurs, you know, real money, we've talked about this for 5 years, and actually your family's talked about it for 40 years, David. Real gold is real money. And so are we seeing that paradigm shift coming into also the realization that gold may be money?
Sure, we are. Now, I mean, in terms of the price action of gold, just a comment or two on that. We're not out of the woods yet. We're sitting around 1620, just above 1600. We're getting closer to the next uptrend, and this next price move may surprise everyone, frankly, on the upside. Year-end prices of sort of 1900 to 2100 would not surprise us, but it makes these levels very attractive to be accumulating at. I think obviously downside exists, but in the face of limited central bank options globally, not just in the United States, we see the downside as tolerable and the risk versus reward relationship is compelling. Honestly, that can't be said of hardly any other asset class today where downside risks are tolerable versus the upside reward. So psychologically, it is easier to buy an asset that is immediately gratifying in terms of an increase in price. To me, I think, though, the smart money knows that building a position in any asset class entails purchases at a variety of prices, preferably at the lower end of the short-term fluctuations, and that's what we've had. We continue to build a position in gold and silver ourselves and certainly encourage folks to do the same, not confusing short-term volatility with what has been a consistent and solid long-term trend. I'm speaking straight from experience today. I bought my first gold from the China Gold. It's actually called the China National Gold Group Corporation, and it is sponsored by the government. They sell gold all over China, And I looked at my renminbi, and even though by the Big Mac Index it's undervalued, I still didn't mind parting with a little bit of fiat for a few more grams of gold.
Well, and David, I have to think how ironic it is, all right, and maybe it's more than irony, maybe this is actually by design, that you've got a country, China, all right, this is a communist country that actually has a national gold exchange, and they encourage their people. They sell gold to their people, and you know, David, the old saying, he who owns the gold ultimately makes the rules, I think it's a strange contrast, okay? You're in China. You're buying gold in China. They have no problem with you switching out of your currency and going into gold. In fact, it's encouraged. Yet here we have an organization that's supposedly representing the nation that discourages the purchase of gold. In fact, it encourages us to just continue to accumulate dollars. Now, dollars are based on nothing, but with the European situation here recently, the dollar has had an unusual rally. I'm wondering if that's sustainable, if we have real value in the dollar returning, or if we're just still on the decrease.
You know, the rally from 72.5 on the euro index to 83.5 has been what we expected. We've got continued stress in the eurozone that makes the U.S. dollar the best looking horse in the glue factory, as one of our guests is fond of saying. And, you know, the rally may in fact continue to the high 80s, although frankly it's looking a little tired at present. And the euro has been sort of refusing to break down below 120. If interest rates were allowed to rise in the U.S., that would certainly be a dollar positive. You'd have fresh inflows satisfied both with being in a liquid pool of capital, and they'd be more impressed with the yield. I guess they'd be impressed with any yield at this point. Right. On that point, though, I think it's important to remember, though, that we really have to see a significant rise in interest rates to have a negative impact on metals. So, I mean, we're talking about a positive real rate of return that's several percentage points above where we are today. So after taxes, after inflation, you make a couple of percent, and then gold lacks a little bit of its luster. But we're a long way off from that, considering that we're in negative rate territory today.
Well, exactly. It's what you're talking about. To make a real rate of return today, you have to factor what the real inflation rate is. And we've talked about that. That can be anywhere from 7 to 9%, depending on what index you look at. And then still get a positive 1 or 2, maybe even 3%, because you still have to factor in taxes as well. So we're a long, long, dangerous way, frankly, away from 10% interest rates. Our government couldn't possibly afford its debt if we had 10% on the interest rate. Am I right on that?
Yeah, no, there's a reason why they're keeping rates low. It's the only way you can afford to make payments on $16 trillion worth of debt. You do run into a bit of an issue in terms of cash flow squeeze if your interest rates are much higher. So, yeah, I think when we look at the dollar, yes, it's traded higher, but interestingly, it's traded higher along with equities. And that's odd of late. They've been trading in opposite directions, and now they're moving in lockstep to the upside, and frankly, along with gold. And this is muddying the asset class distinctions, which we think will sort of be clarified and the silt will drift to the bottom over the next 60 days. The merits of each of these asset classes, or the lack thereof, may become more apparent. And we think that over the next 60 to 90 days, there will be a return to appreciating the fundamentals driving each of these markets.
Well, and David, you know, we in the past have been trained that the dollar was the safe place to be if you were not going to go into the stock market. But right now, it seems that every little bit of bad news, it's bringing just the short-term traders in, and they're driving up equities. You know, the Dow right now doesn't seem to represent any kind of reality or strength. You've got the high-frequency trading and a lot of the strange bits that are coming into the stock market right now, bringing this thing up into the 13,000-point range. What's your thought on the Dow?
You know, the worse things get, the more traders bid up equities. They're really convinced that the Fed will do something in the form of stimulus. And you know, we've seen a rapid deterioration in earnings. Full-year expectations are being slashed by most of your companies out there. And it's become grossly apparent that the stock market is not trading on fundamentals or even technical indicators, but rather just the hopeful wishes of Wall Street traders. They've already bought the recovery story, and frankly, they're refusing to admit being in error. Nothing is more powerful, ultimately, and disruptive than unmet expectations. And this is our concern in terms of the Dow. Point here is that with prices reaching the outer limits of valuation sanity, if you will, we see late summer, early fall as potentially catastrophic in the U.S. equities market. Barring the Fed, slinging $1 trillion or more into, you know, expanded asset purchases or some other form of quantitative easing, you're going to see some real pressures there because, again, you've got hype and hope that are driving this market. Hype and hope is not a good investment thesis.
Well, and, you know, talk about hype and hope. Mario Draghi last week said, we will do whatever it takes to save the euro. Now, you can't just come out and say those things without it affecting not only the currency value, but interest rates themselves. You can see interest rates change pretty dramatically by just a single comment, can't you?
Yeah, the 10-year last week was amazing. We were in the 140s with an eye on 125 before Draghi's comments. It reversed the trend at the end of the week. And, you know, what these moves to lower levels are implying is the financial community sees deleveraging and deflation as the primary threat. The bet that very few are making at this point is central bank efforts to fight this deflation could, in fact, fail. And the other thing that I think that it neglects is that we may see select asset classes inflate as a result of the central bank activities, whether that's Draghi's comments, you know, we await with bated breath, Bernanke's comments this week, will he ride in on a white horse and save the day? We don't know. But there are assets, Kevin, that are likely to take on sort of the characteristics of money, and it will be trading, I think, very differently than any asset class that has debt against it.
Well, David, as you say this in the back of my mind, because the majority right now, you're right, is thinking, oh, we've got to watch out for deflation. And frankly, we know that even if we go into a deflation, all deflations tend to end in hyperinflation or high inflation. But I can't help but picture your dad in the back of my mind. You know, I've known him 25 years, and he would just sort of chuckle and get that look on his face and talk about the majority. They weren't necessarily complimentary comments.
No. The majority is always wrong was one of the principles that he'd share in the opening notes of any of his lectures. And I do wonder if the consensus view on deflation isn't painting with too broad a brushstroke. In a deleveraging, not all assets are affected. And certainly the assets which are most vulnerable are those with a liability component to them. In the case of gold and silver, they're no one's liability. A number of global asset managers are beginning to connect the dots on this.
David, there's a brilliant manager over at Templeton who has been there for many years. I think he's been there a couple of decades because I've been watching his career, a guy named Mark Mobius, and he really was ahead of the curve. He's been ahead of the curve on emerging markets and money management for years. And strangely enough, I've never heard Mobius talking about gold, but he's now saying to keep the fiat currency from completely failing, we're going to ultimately have to have some form of gold standard.
Well, before we discuss the Mobius interview, I just want to finish this idea of Treasury strength versus weakness, because it's not long-term oriented money that is lining up for voluntary losses in the Treasury market today. And by voluntary losses, I mean you're running negative real rates of return. Someone's taking a hit up front and they know it and they're happy to do that. Buying short-dated paper and sitting with a negative real return and smiling about it is done by a group of people with a very short-term perspective. What I mean is this. You've got professional money that has a gut instinct about the instability in the world financial markets and has considered what a total meltdown looks like. Taking a little hit is, to this audience, a far better way to approach it than taking a big hit. The big hit may very well be around the corner. So professional money is sitting on these minor losses as an acceptable loss, knowing that the gain is one of opportunity in the future. But underlying their choice is this assumption. While commercial counterparties are more and more suspect, we can thank Mr. Corzine and everyone's concerned about commercial counterparties. We also have sovereign counterparties, which are, again, this assumption, are believed to be a better bet. Yet the history of finance is replete with sovereigns walking away or inflating away their obligations. I guess if you're looking at the U.S. Treasury market today, the one truly great thing about our U.S. debt obligations is that they are, in fact, dollar denominated. This is in stark contrast to the previous default cycles we've seen in Latin America and other parts of the world, where predominantly the debt that they defaulted on were denominated in a foreign currency. And so, again, we look at that, and yes, it's an advantage that gives us sort of a veneer of stability in the U.S. Treasury market.
Well, and David, you've brought out in the past that if you borrow money in your own currency, if you can print that money, it's really not a concern as far as default you're probably not going to default. You're probably just going to print more money, which, you know, leads again to the devaluation of the fiat currency in the long run. You know, we've talked about the potential of the United States being able to just on a slow drip, what we would call a slow drip, just continue to feed quantitative easing into the system ad infinitum. Would that not warrant some sort of discipline or gold standard in the future once the currency finally reduces itself to where it's no longer a valid issue?
Yeah, well, and I think that's what Mobius was getting at in his CNBC Asia interview earlier this week. Major central banks, this is what they commented on in the article. Major central banks are all desperate to stimulate their economies. Some say currencies have entered a dangerous new phase, often described as a race to the bottom. And this is exactly what they say in the interview. Mark Mobius, executive chairman of Templeton Emerging Markets Group, says investors will soon start to demand fiat currencies be backed by gold or other hard assets. Quote, it's already happening. You're beginning to see that trend with central banks stocking up on gold. The estimate is that at least half of the buying is central bank buying. They're looking to the day when they can say, okay, our currency is backed by gold, and therefore we're a strong country. Kevin, I mean, to me, it's fantastic to have bought my first gold from China Gold today and know that this is a part of their MO. A grand strategy may be internationalizing the RMB, and it may take them 10 years to get that done. But the project is going to be supported. If you want to know what the substructure of their currency will be 10 years hence, it will be built on a gold standard, even if it's just partially backed. But if you want to see the purchasing power of the Chinese consumer unleashed, see their currency appreciate in light of the inherent strength of the currency.
Well, and David, you know, it's such a contrast. And again, this is what we're trying to do is look at China and contrast it with what we see here in America. The contrast, I look at CNBC and I look at the various financial television programs right now, and I think they could almost be renamed Bernanke TV because there's just been a desperate need since we're still clinging so hard to the dollar, just a worthless currency. And yet other countries such as China are moving the direction of gold. We're clinging to this fiat currency. And what it's doing is it's making us completely dependent on the next verbiage coming out of the Federal Reserve. It's scary that we're in this place.
Well, central bankers have become essentially demigods in our marketplace today. From 1 week to the next, markets are dramatically, and granted, this can be only on a temporary basis, but markets can be dramatically impacted by central bank language or even occasionally when they take action. And this is, in my mind, producing greater degrees of fragility in and instability, ultimately, in the financial markets. I say this because if the markets wake up one day and you see prices in disarray in the Dow or the S&P or the NASDAQ, and central bankers have essentially lost the game of print to save, if you want to call it that, then I think you'll find us in a very nasty pricing vortex. 1987 comes to mind. The equivalent drop today in terms of point drops would be over 2,000-point drop in the Dow to be the equivalent of that 87 drop. We can't rule out those circumstances. And again, it's because so much desperate hope is being put into the central bank demagogue.
All right, Dave, so that we don't just always be accused of talking just money or politics, I know one of your closest things to your heart is food. And wherever you travel, you seem to find the places that serve the best food. Now, you've been to Singapore. You've been to Hong Kong. You've been to Beijing. What have you discovered on that side of things? Is there food there that's worth the trip?
We have such an unfair advantage. We've been going around with the film crew in Beijing, and the guys and gals that are with us have taken us to some amazing out-of-the-way spots. And I tell you what, it's time for a bowl of Beijing noodles, just thinking about it. I've discovered that my palate prefers sort of North and Western Chinese cuisine. It's a little bit more savory, it seems to me. And yeah, what a delight. Having said that, going back here shortly to Singapore, pick up my whole family, and then we move on in our journey. In Singapore, off the street, for $4, you can have one of the most amazing meals of your life.
Well, and David, we're not going to be able to smell or even see the food in the video that you're coming back with. But David, you said you were traveling with a film crew, and I know this is for the second portion of this year's DVD. When do you expect that we're going to have the Asian portion of this DVD available to our listeners?
sometime in September for sure. We've got a lot of the story that still has to be put together, but there in September, we should have it available. If we've got email addresses, you'll have it post-haste. Otherwise, it'll be 6 to 8 weeks before a hard copy is available. So if you're interested in the analysis and the conversations we're having with economists here in Asia, then by all means, make sure we have the means of communicating with you directly and quickly. Shoot us your email, and we'll make sure that you get one of the first views as we send out the email notification here in just a matter of weeks.
Well, I know, David, we're looking forward to your return trip and your family. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.